Welcome and good evening. I believe we have a quorum, so we'll call the meeting to order at 6 o'clock. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Region Advisory Council. My name is Mike Lauder. I'm the co-chair for the Northern Region RAC, and I'm representing or filling in for Justin Oliver this evening. I represent Sportsman out of Hooper. At this time, I ask the council to introduce themselves. We'll start on that side.
Kevin McLeod, at-large, Plain City.
Aaron Johnson, Sportsman, West Weber.
Chris Oakstrom, Ogden, non-consumptive.
Randy Hutchison, Ogden, at-large.
Ryan Brown, Camas, Utah, at-large.
Emily Gento, Salt Lake Field Office, BLM.
David Earle, Ag, Beaver Dam, Utah.
Paul Chase, Forest Service, out of Logan.
Darren Perry, Shoshone Nation.
Matt Clark, Ogden, at large.
Justin Doling, I'm with the Division of Wildlife, and I serve as the Executive Secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
I'd like to recognize the Chairman of the Wildlife Board, Mr. Byron Bateman. We appreciate him coming out and listening to the RAC meetings. Please join me in turning off our ringers on our electronic devices so that we may have an uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy, rules, and regulations. The council then takes the recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five Regional Advisory Councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Please respect everyone's right to an opinion, even if it conflicts with yours. There are no need for clapping or vocal outbursts to support or criticize others' comments. The meeting will be recorded for transcription of the minutes. The audio recording and minutes will be available on the DWR website. When speaking, please use the microphone. Speak clearly into them. The public will use the microphone located at the front and center of the audience. Speakers should state their name and, if they wish, where they are from. Please take a look at the agenda for tonight's meeting. If there are no objections, we will approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. There being no objection, the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. The next business in order to approve the minutes from the previous meeting. Everyone should have received a copy of the minutes via email. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved as circulated. The next business in order is the Wildlife Board update, and Justin will help with that and provide that for us.
Okay, so a little update on what happened at the Wildlife Board. The fur bearer bobcat harvest recommendations for 2019 and 2020 were accepted as presented, and the move to a three-year management plan was also accepted, and that passed unanimously. On to the cougar recommendations. There were several motions here, so kind of bear with me. The first one was to move that the Division of Wildlife maintain the cash unit permits at 25 rather than decrease it as the division proposed, and that passed unanimously. The second motion was to move the Buckcliffs unit back to a harvest objective with the same number of permits as last year. That one also passed unanimously. The third was to move the Southwest Manti unit. Move that the Southwest Manti unit remain a split season and keep the permit numbers at 18. That one also passed unanimously. The next motion was to accept the RAC's recommendations to increase the permit numbers to 26 on the Southeast Manti unit, and that passed 3-2. Carl and Randy were opposed. The next motion was to increase the permit numbers to 12 on the Ochre Stansberry West and keep it as a harvest objective. That passed 4-1 with Brett Selman opposed. The next motion was to decrease the permit numbers on the Ochre Stansberry East unit to 7. And that motion basically died for the lack of a second. And then there was a motion made to approve the remainder of the 2019-20 Cougar recommendations and rule amendments in reference to specific units and tags as presented by the division. That passed unanimously. Then there was a couple other motions that kind of clarified that motion. The next one was to follow the bear management plan of rounding down the split for resident and non-resident permits to maintain consistency. That passed unanimously. The next motion was to move that we pull the 3-year recommendation cycle from the previous motion and open it up for discussion prior to a vote. That one passed unanimously. And then there was a motion to move to adopt the 3-year management plan for Cougar. And that one passed 3-2 with Brett Selman and Wade Heaton opposed. And then the last motion was to move that we amend the motion to state that we apply a 3-year average within the management plan but have an annual cycle for permit number approvals. And then after a lot of discussion, that motion was actually withdrawn. So I think the only thing that was contrary to what our RAC recommended was East Canyon, and that East Canyon, based on the larger motion, stayed as a split unit with increased permit numbers, if I recall correctly. Any questions on that?
You said the book cliffs did go back to harvest objective.
Correct. Okay, moving on to our regional update. I'll just briefly go through the different sections here in the region and give you a little feel for what's going on or what may be going on in the future. Our Great Salt Lake program is getting ready for the brine shrimp cyst harvest season. That starts October 1st. And then the waterfowl marshes are gearing up for the waterfowl youth hunt, which is September 21st. And then the general opener, which starts October 5th. The wildlife section is still working on preseason elk and pronghorn classifications. They're gathering up camera trap data for estimating chucker trends. This is kind of a new thing that they started this year in the absence of doing helicopter surveys. That's got so cost prohibitive. So they've tried to do this chucker trap, camera trap type estimate to get a feel for trends. And basically that effort is done now, and they'll be looking at those different camera trap data results. Then the youth chucker hunt is September 21st through the 23rd, and the division does have releases planned throughout our region, so should be a good youth hunt. In outreach, they have a new staff member. Her name is Haley Smith. She's our outreach specialist. And she will start, I think, in the middle of September. Outreach is also planning a mentored duck hunt with the Delta Waterfowl Foundation. In our aquatic section, they're gearing up for a second round of rotenone treatments on Big Creek, and that'll occur in mid-September, and that's basically a cutthroat trout restoration effort. They're also planning on doing some kokanee spawn counts at Porcupine, Smith and Morehouse, and Causey Reservoirs, and possibly a new community fishery pond will come on in West Haven. And then in our habitat section, they're working on four fire rehab projects in West Box Elder County. A couple of weeks ago, there were about 10, maybe 12 small fires that started in West Box Elder, several on the Hog Up Mountains and even further west than that. So they've identified at least four of those fires that could use some rehab efforts. And lastly, in the habitat section, they plan to install 12 beaver dam analogs on the South Fork of the Chalk Creek. And then law enforcement is gearing up for our upland game hunts. They indicate to me that the bow hunt has been fairly slow so far, but they are working a couple pretty big, significant cases as a result of the archery hunt. So that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Hey, Justin, just a quick question. When's that checker information going to be released?
I would assume that would come out just prior to the hunt. The thing I'm not certain about is I believe this is the first year, so we won't really have a trend. We're going to have just a point in time, and so it may not be very meaningful until we get at least three dots on the graph.
Okay.
Beaver dam analog. I didn't understand what that is.
So a beaver dam analog is like an artificial beaver dam. They'll pound treated posts into the stream bed at about 1 foot intervals, and then weave either woody vegetation or willows, any kind of vegetation that's adjacent to the stream channel, in and out of those configured logs, and then they push that stuff down into the stream bed, set it in, and then it acts as an artificial dam, which hopefully will entice a beaver to build upon, kind of a stimulus to continue the construction of a larger dam.
Okay, the meeting will proceed as follows. A representative from the Division of Wildlife Resources will make a presentation on the agenda item. Then we'll have a question from the public on the presentation. This time is for questions only, not comments. Next, we will have questions from the council on the presentation. Then we will take comments from the public on the agenda item. Persons representing themselves will have 3 minutes to comment. Persons representing organized groups will have 5 minutes to comment. In either case, please fill out the blue comment card if you wish to comment and indicate if you would like to address the council or provide a written comment. At the end of the public comment period, the public portion of the agenda item ends and further public participation will only be at the request of the council for clarification. Next, the council will comment on the agenda item. Then the council will make motions recommending action by the Wildlife Board on the agenda item, deliberate those motions, and vote. Okay, we're going to start with the fishing informational from Craig Walker from the Aquatic Section Assistant Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members. Tonight I'd like to present to you two informational presentations, the first of which is titled Tailoring Angler Opportunities to Meet Angler Needs, How We Plan for the 2021 Regulation Cycle and Beyond. So first, why is it important that we tailor angler opportunities to meet angler needs? You might notice that gentleman in the picture right there. First, we need to do a better job addressing our public's needs. And this was made apparent to us in 2018 after we proposed the removal of a special fly and lure-only regulation in southern Utah waters. Some of you may remember that. The Wildlife Board did not approve that proposed removal due to an apparent mismatch with angler desires that were expressed at the board meeting and in our RACs. Additionally, in 2018, anglers expressed concerns over, firstly, the removal of select brook trout populations in the state, and fishing opportunities for brook trout in Utah, and secondly, the need for more bait fishing opportunities on rivers throughout Utah. After that feedback, we internally agreed among ourselves and agreed in kind of a pact with the Wildlife Board to examine the angling experiences, for example, gear restrictions, limits, species, locations, etc., offered statewide, and compare them with angler preferences. Tailoring angler opportunities to meet angler needs will also help the Division of Wildlife address the potential for angler crowding. Right now, we have a forecasted Utah population growth from 3.2 million residents currently to 5.5 million residents by 2050. We have a stable angling participation rate, and if you combine those two things, that equates to about a 7% increase in the number of anglers that we'll have out on the landscape by 2025, a 26% increase in the number of anglers that we'll see out there by 2040, and a 39% increase in the number of anglers that we anticipate out on the landscape by 2050. Given the fact that the perception of crowding among anglers is one of the main reasons that they've ceased fishing participation, we are very concerned with how we're going to carve up our opportunities and make sure that this growing angling public has the ability to go out and recreate. Further, making sure that we're providing satisfying angling experiences is critical to ensuring the relevancy of angling among other outdoor recreational pursuits. To ensure satisfaction among our anglers, we need to make sure that the desired experiences are available proportional to their need. For example, and this is just an example, if 20% of anglers prefer to fish for largemouth bass at lakes and reservoirs, then we should strive to manage for largemouth bass fishing opportunities at 20% of our lakes and reservoirs. Just makes sense to do that. Additionally, maintaining angler satisfaction will also require that we ensure that the unique ways anglers participate in the sport of fishing don't conflict with one another. I mentioned the fact that we're going to have a growing population of anglers out there. We're not building any new waters to any great degree, and we're going to encounter conflict if we don't work toward segregating uses to a certain extent. Similar to the USDA Forest Service model, where you have OHV access, foot and horse access to the same area, but via different access points. So now you know a little bit about the why we're trying to provide anglers with the opportunities that they desire. How do we propose that we get there? And it's not by catching two crappie on a tandem rig, but it's a cool picture. There are four avenues that the Division's Aquatic Section would like to pursue to meet the needs of anglers. First, we would like to begin assessing angler preferences and behaviors. In 2017, we surveyed more than 10,000 anglers via an email survey, and that survey was distributed proportional to anglers' representation among all of the licensed anglers. For example, we stratified it by license type and gender. We would like to analyze the responses from this survey to identify angler behaviors and preferred experiences. We'd like to use behavior and preference results to define what we term preference groups among Utah anglers who seek common experiences. For example, anglers who fish for similar species in similar settings using similar gear types would be considered to be a group. Identify where those angler preference groups are willing to fish. For example, are anglers willing to travel within 2 hours of their zip code for a preferred experience? We'd like to identify the experiences we currently offer via an inventory. We'd like to actually identify a variety of experiences that each water is capable of providing. So what we term as an inventory is what we offer, what those water bodies are currently being managed for. What we're terming an assessment of capacity is an assessment of what those waters could possibly provide if we wanted to change the way we manage those waters. For example, does a water we currently manage for trout have the capacity to be managed for bass, for wiper, possibly for kokanee? Could current regulations be modified at a water to allow for greater harvest? Could regulations be modified at a water to create a gear-specific, for example, fly-only fishing experience? Could infrastructure improvements be made to increase accessibility for shore anglers in some instances? Could habitat be manipulated to create new experiences at a certain water? Or could smaller fish be stocked at higher densities to increase angler catch rates at a water currently managed for lower catch rates but for trophy fish? Thirdly, we'd like to plan on looking at what we term gaps, and those gaps are the mismatches between what anglers prefer and what we currently offer. Where are the gaps between preferred fishing experiences and the experiences we currently offer at the waters in the state of Utah? Where are the opportunities to use what I talked about, capacity of waters, as a vehicle to address these potential gaps? And then take inventory of what gaps we have that we can't currently address with any of the management objectives that we have outlined. Finally, we'd like to look at those data through the lens of what I like to term a willingness to travel. Willingness to travel is simply the distance an angler is willing to travel to experience their preferred outcome. We'd like to look at where anglers with preferred fishing experiences reside and then examine whether there are opportunities nearby for those people to experience within a radius that they are willing to travel. So, let's see. It's been about 6 months since we've been working on this. Sorry about the microphone. It's been about 6 months since we've been working on this. Right now, I'd like to go through some of the things that we've accomplished to date as far as our analyses. We've gone through the angler data from the 2017 angler survey that I mentioned earlier to assess angler preferences and behaviors. We've looked at preferred species, preferred water type, gear preferences, preferred access methods as well. And we've looked at the time spent pursuing various species by both resident and non-resident anglers. With regard to species preference, we've evaluated the strength of the relationship between species preferences, specific species preferences, to define what I mentioned earlier, these preference groups. And in this case, it's preference groups related to various groupings of species. 10% of Utah anglers, based upon that assessment, like to fish for lake salmonids. 4% prefer to fish for warm water fishes, or what you commonly would call panfish. 8% prefer to fish for bass and walleye. 68% prefer to fish for stream salmonids, and 10% are coming up as what we term as generalists that really don't fit into any one of those other four buckets. Additionally, we've looked at species preferences among our non-resident anglers and found that non-resident anglers who prefer to fish for warm water species seem to have a greater preference for crappie, and that'll come into play later when I describe some of the things we might do with this information. We've defined method and setting preferences among our anglers by evaluating the strength of the relationship between fishing method and preferred setting to define the following groups. 8% of Utah anglers appear to like to fish at lakes via boat. 18% like to fish at lakes via the shoreline. And 74% of our anglers in Utah are what we term wading anglers, those that are actively pursuing under their own power their fish quarry. Additionally, we have identified the gear preferences among our anglers. 22% of Utah anglers appear to prefer to fish with lures. 28% prefer to fish with flies. 46% prefer bait, and 4% prefer some other terminal tackle when they're fishing. Most importantly, I think we've taken the next step where we begin to look at the relationships between these preferences that I've described thus far. Specifically, in this case, we've examined the relationship between species preference and gear preference. And I don't know, do I have a pointer? No. Let's see if I can actually, does that show up? Nope. I'll wing it. So if you look at this in the terms of quadrants, the top left quadrant, we have those anglers that prefer to fish for bass and walleye and lake salmonids. They prefer to also fish for those species groups using lures. If you go over to the two right quadrants, we have those that fish for stream salmonids as a preference, and they use flies. If you go down to the bottom left quadrant, we have those folks that fish for warm water or panfish, or that are generalists, and they prefer to fish with bait. A lot of this starts to seem like, oh, that's a no-brainer. Isn't that a given? But it's important that it does actually feel intuitive, because that means that the analyses that we're undertaking are actually pointing in the right direction. What I'd like to also point out is on the x-axis, we have an orientation from left to right, from lakes to streams. And you'll notice that in some of the other graphs that I provide. On the y-axis, we have what I'd like to term a gear investment component. Those that are fishing with bait that prefer warm water species or are generalists have less of an investment in the gear that they're fishing with. Those that prefer to fish for stream salmonids as they work their way through what I term a recreation opportunity spectrum are fishing with flies, a little bit more of an investment in their sport. Those that fish for bass and walleye, lake salmonids, are fishing with lures and hardware, a little bit more of an investment in their sport. Again, gear investment on that y-axis. We've also looked at the relationship between angler gear preferences and the preferences for access methods at particular settings. So this is another comparison. If you look at the top left quadrant, we have individuals that prefer to fish at lakes via boat, fishing with lures. We have those that prefer to fish by wading, fishing with flies. We have those that prefer to fish on lakes, on the shoreline, preferring to fish with bait. Again, on the x-axis, we move from left to right, lakes to streams as an orientation. But then on the y-axis, we have a slightly different orientation. We have folks moving from a sedentary behavior on lake shorelines using bait all the way up to starting to use their own power to go after their quarry using flies while they're wading, and then actually using motorized power to pursue fish on lakes by boat using lures. So with regard to behaviors, we've begun to examine some resident and non-resident anglers' investment of time when pursuing various species in Utah and elsewhere. What I'd like to point out firstly is the fact that Utah residents right now invest the majority of their time fishing here in Utah. This is a pretty good indication to us that we are providing a quality product, and then they're not having to seek satisfying fishing experiences elsewhere. The second thing I'd like to point out is the large investment of time that non-resident anglers apparently spend pursuing warm water fishing opportunities in Utah. You remember the figure that I showed you earlier, I talked about the crappie. The fact that those non-residents who prefer to fish for warm water species also prefer to fish for crappie. These results, combined with what you see here, are a pretty good indication to us that non-resident anglers are coming to Utah for crappie fishing opportunities, likely at Lake Powell. The third finding that I'd like to point out on this graphic is the fact that non-resident anglers are investing a greater amount of time pursuing bass and walleye opportunities in other states. And this indicates to us that there might be better angling opportunities for these species outside of the state of Utah. So I'd now like to walk you through a few examples of some of the changes we might undertake based upon some of the preliminary results that I'm showing you tonight. First, we might change regulations, and in this case, crappie regulations. I mentioned that non-resident anglers seek warm water fishing experiences in Utah more than in other states. I also mentioned that non-resident warm water anglers in Utah are more likely to prefer crappie. Liberalizing crappie regulations at some Utah waters would likely encourage greater non-resident angler use as a result of these two other findings. Second, we might change how we manage certain species in Utah. Non-resident anglers seek bass and walleye fishing experiences in other states more than Utah. What we need to do is conduct an examination of largemouth bass and walleye management efforts in other states and compare them with what we're doing in Utah. Ask the hard question, can we improve our bass and walleye management efforts in the state of Utah? If we can improve our bass and walleye management efforts in the state, we might be able to attract more non-resident anglers to Utah. And I know I'm harping on the non-resident aspect of things, but they seem to be the strongest relationships, and they gave a pretty good example of what we can actually do. Third, we might change how we manage access and amenities at certain settings. We talked about the fact that anglers who prefer to fish for warm water species are more likely to fish from shore using bait. Additional preliminary analyses that I didn't present here tonight suggest that anglers are more likely to keep fish for food and prefer to fish at locations where we have good amenities, restrooms, and fish cleaning stations when they're fishing from shorelines at lakes. Right now, for those of you that have tried to fish at shorelines, along shorelines of lakes in Utah, really don't have a lot of developed shoreline access in the state. And that's something we've known for over a decade. Additionally, outside of community fisheries, we don't have any fish cleaning stations that are tailored to the needs of shoreline anglers. Again, harvest-oriented anglers, but we don't have any avenue for them to actually clean their fish. Right now, we feel that improving shoreline angling opportunities will address the needs of an underserved portion of Utah's angling public as a result of some of the results that we've seen so far. So, where do we go from here? Like I mentioned, this is just a preliminary analysis. We've only been doing this for 6 months. We'd like to continue to evaluate the preferences and groups of anglers that we can create from existing survey data. We'd like to examine the willingness to travel among the identified angler preference groups residing in certain localities. We'd like to inventory and assess capacity of existing fisheries to meet the needs of angler preference groups. We'd like to modify the management of our fisheries where needed and where feasible to meet the needs of our anglers. We'd like to address the gaps with the creation of new angling opportunities. Those are the gaps I mentioned earlier. We'd like to examine another survey that we undertook in 2017 and the data from that survey. It's called the Lapsed Angler Survey, to assess what constraints are out there to angling participation. And we'd like to bring before you in increments at 2-year intervals proposed data-driven regulatory changes between 2021 and 2029 to kind of hone our management of waters in Utah to meet our ever-changing situation. We'd like to continue to survey anglers at 5-year intervals in a manner that allows for adaptation to that changing angler preference and behavior situation, the changing habitat conditions that you all know we're facing, and the increased demand that I showcased earlier in my presentation. And finally, we'd like to continue to survey anglers to assess their response to the management changes, basically continually taking their pulse in response to these changes that we're planning on bringing forward to you at 2-year intervals. And with that, I'll take any input, feedback, or questions on that informational.
Thanks, Craig. Are there any questions from the public? Any questions from the council? Kevin?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, in the statistical information that you've gathered from surveying, you know, I've always worried about the youth, whether it's hunting or fishing. Kids want to catch fish. They don't really care how big they are most of the time. So I'm just wondering, is there any avenue, and it's probably difficult to do, to gather that statistical information through survey that focuses on youth usage and what they would like to see?
Yeah, I think the vehicle that we have as far as providing opportunities consistently for youth is our community waters. That was one of the original objectives for the development of that program, to recruit young anglers into the sport of fishing. This upcoming year, starting in the spring of 2020, we are beginning to unveil a pilot program. We're going to try to emulate what Idaho has been doing with a tagged fish program, where they try to assess exploitation or harvest of their fish in an effort to be able to figure out how many fish they need to raise and how many fish they need to stock and do it accurately. As part of that pilot, which is going to be conducted on the community waters, we're going to be running a concurrent creel at least 12 community waters throughout the state. That creel will begin to gather information from our younger anglers. And I think that's going to really tap into what they want and what they're seeking in the future, for sure.
Thank you.
Yep.
Randy? Just a quick question for you, Craig. And it may just be the way you presented it, but it seemed like the focus was on making changes for the out-of-state angler, but the vast majority of the people that fish here are in-state.
Yeah.
So is focusing on the out-of-state going to have any negative impact on the resident?
Like I mentioned in the presentation, it seems that way. They were some of the strongest relationships that we had derived thus far, and therefore gave you a good example of the power of the information that we're collecting. This is by no means a non-resident recruitment or tourism development effort. It's done in a balanced approach. I could have presented other information related to Utah anglers specifically, more similar to the shoreline, lake shoreline access opportunities and amenity development that we'd like to undertake to address that underserved part of our public. But no, it's not disproportional to the representation in our overall angling representation, 600,000 or so anglers. So,
any other questions from the council? Great. Well, thanks, Craig. We appreciate you.
One more information. So Stacy told me I needed to do a transition. So here's my transition. Yeah, I get a 3 for tonight.
Okay. So I should announce the next item. So the next item is the private fish ponds rule amendments.
I have one more informational. Yep. Okay. And then we get into the private ponds.
Okay.
So Stacy didn't discern, she just said informational. It's actually two presentations. The second informational presentation that I'd like to provide you with tonight is what we propose to do when we're trying to simplify certificates of registration for fishing tournaments in the state. First, a little bit of background for those of you that don't know what CORs are or what the COR process is. A certificate of registration is a special permit that covers certain wildlife-related activities. People who want to participate in such activities require a COR and have to apply for their permit using a paper application downloaded from the Division of Wildlife Resources website as a PDF. They then print that PDF or print and scan that PDF and send it to us. Those applications are then reviewed by both regional and Salt Lake DWR personnel and then are approved or denied on a case-by-case basis. So it's, as you can see, kind of a clunky process. And for that reason, the COR application process has come under some recent scrutiny. The public is dissatisfied with what they view as a flawed certificate of registration application process. We are overly burdened with what we view as a time-consuming application review process. And as a result, we continually have a backlog of our COR applications awaiting approval. The DWR directors have directed us to create a more efficient COR application process for all of our CORs. One of the first efforts that we'd like to undertake when we first begin to develop better, more efficient application processes is to look at the fishing tournament COR application process. That application process would be automated, is what we're proposing. And that automated process would provide guidance to applicants regarding the eligibility of their request. It would address the rule requirements as they relate to AIS certification, number of participants, prize value, live weigh-ins, species, and adherence to fishing regulations. And those are all stipulated in the rule related to fishing tournament CORs currently. The automated fishing tournament COR would also address what we term as the primary function of the fishing tournament COR, and that's to prevent the scheduling of multiple tournaments out of water on the same day, which is designed to minimize conflicts among tournament anglers and with non-tournament anglers on that water. The online application would address the conflict by not allowing tournaments to occur on any of the following days. And this, again, is coming straight out of the rule associated with this. Holidays, free fishing day, any location and or date determined by the Division of Wildlife Resources or other land managers, for example, the Forest Service as a partner or State Parks as a partner, to be ineligible for a tournament, or a date at a location already secured for another fishing tournament, again, mitigating that conflict. It should be noted that we are attempting to provide guidance to applicants regarding their eligibility of their request and the rule requirements associated with their request. So for example, if individuals are requesting a fishing tournament COR for a tournament that entails the use of boats, we will harp on the AIS certification aspect of the rule and make sure that people are well-versed in what the eligibility of the request and rule requirements are. So what I'd like to do right now is walk you through kind of a four-scenario mock-up of what our DTS folks have put together that gives you kind of a foreshadowing of what our automated tool might eventually look like. As you see here in front of you, this would be the initial splash page where a questionnaire would be presented to a COR applicant looking to conduct a fish tournament. And based upon the information that they would enter, they would automatically be sent into one of four avenues, the first of which is one that entails what we term a date collision. They would be notified, as you see here in this orange box, that this event would indeed need DWR authorization, but the dates that they have chosen for that specific location have already been reserved for a tournament. They either have to adjust their tournament dates or select another water body. And then once they do that, they can actually click and go through the process. The next step in the process would be additional information collection regarding the director of the tournament and their organization. Again, I mentioned in the event that they actually were using a boat in their tournament, they would be required to sign off on that they understand the rules and stipulations related to AIS and decontamination. They would be then prompted to go to a payment screen. And after submitting their payment, they would be provided with an authorization or COR for printing or electronic download via email. The second scenario that we see coming through is a simpler one. In this case, they will need DWR authorization, but there is no conflict with another water or date. They'll be prompted to walk through the process like I walked through before. They will enter in additional information. In the case of boat use, they will be required to put AIS certification information and sign off on their understanding of those rules and stipulations. They'll submit their payment, and then they'll be provided with an authorized COR in a printable or electronic format. The third scenario, and this is interesting, right now we have people that go through this process. They submit a tournament COR application. They get into that backlog that I talked about earlier. They wait for a long period of time to find out that indeed they don't really need a COR. And it's really doing our public a disservice. In this case, with an automated tool, they will be immediately informed after entering in their initial information that this tournament does not need DWR authorization, and go have fun. Go do your thing. And the final scenario is a tagged fish contest. So individuals that indicate that they would like to perform a tagged fish contest will be informed, as by rule, that they must work in concert with the Division of Wildlife Resources. Tagged fish contests are indeed under the authority of the division and must be overseen by the division. They have to confer with their regional DWR representative prior to identifying a date or location for the tournament and paying their fee. And then we would provide the contact information for those regional personnel. So, that is a mock-up of what we plan on unveiling. Coming soon is the activation of a fully functional application portal for the fishing tournament COR in 2021. And that will include the creation of a monthly report that identifies tournament dates and locations, and this will be publicized on the web for public consumption so that they can actually see where tournaments are taking place if they want to avoid those locations or timeframes. In addition to the automated application portal, we would like to at that time also present a modification to the fishing tournament rule in the fall of 2020. You'll likely see that. Just some background information as to why we'd like to do that. For those of you that haven't read the tournament rule, it is kind of piecemealed together through time. I think historically the fishing tournament COR was designed to prevent over-harvest and mortality of stocked fish. That's not something we deal with on a regular basis as a result of tournaments right now. Really, tournaments are not biologically impactful in Utah. This proposed change will meet the needs of what we think of as a modern angler, those that engage in tournaments, and will also address our management needs and the backlog that I mentioned earlier. And that is my second informational presentation tonight. Thank you, and I'll take any comments or questions.
Are there any questions from the public? Any questions from the council? Thanks, Craig. Craig's going to be representing for Randy Oflinger on fish ponds and rule amendments.
Do my best Randy impersonation. Just a little kudos to Randy. He has worked long and hard on this and other aquaculture and private pond related items, and he's done a great job. Tonight I'd like to present to you what we propose as the development of an aquaponics rule. But before I get there, I'd like to give you a little background on the PAC, or Private Aquaculture Advisory Council, which was established by the Utah Legislature in 2017. The membership of that council is made up of private aquaculturists, private pond owners, anglers, the Division of Wildlife Resources, and UDAV. One of the PAC's goals is to give advice and recommendations to the Wildlife Board on rules adopted concerning the regulation of private fish ponds, private stocking, and short-term fishing events. Another thing that the PAC does is they also advise on the aquatic animal species authorized for importation or use in aquaculture facilities, fee fishing facilities, private fish ponds, short-term fishing events, and private stocking. So during a recent PAC meeting, there was a discussion regarding the topic at hand, which is aquaponics. And the reason for that is aquaponics, as some of you may know, is increasing in popularity within Utah and elsewhere in the country and the world. It is not specifically currently addressed under Division of Wildlife Resources rules, however. We have been handling it as a private fish pond, which it really isn't, under DWR Rule R657-59. And the reason why it needs to be classified as something different is really because it's a little safer. Aquaponics facilities have a lower fish escapement risk than ponds because in most instances they are what we term a closed-loop facility. They are indoors. They receive culinary water as their water source, and the water that they discharge is discharged into a sewer or septic system, making them a lot safer. So the PAC recommended that the division establish criteria where aquaponics facilities can operate without a certificate of registration, making it easier for aquaponics operators. The Division of Wildlife Resources then developed language that was approved by the PAC. And the language is as follows. We recommend adding language to R657-59 that establishes criteria for when an aquaponics facility can operate without a COR. DWR recommends that no COR is necessary provided the following. The aquaponics facility is what we term a hobby operation. That means that it's for personal or educational use. The facility is what I've described earlier as closed loop. All applicable fish health rules are followed when importing the fish used in that facility. Fish cannot leave the facility alive. And the species of fish raised is from a UDWR developed and approved list. Speaking of lists, this is the list that we developed, and I'll just run through it really quickly. It includes bluegill, hybrid bluegill, and specifically the bluegill-green sunfish hybrid, red ear sunfish, green sunfish, striped bass, white bass, hybrid striped bass, or what are termed as wiper, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, channel catfish, yellow perch, fathead minnow, black crappie, white crappie, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, brown trout, brook trout, tiger trout, walleye, and golden shiner. And you might ask, well, what's so special about that list? All of those fish are currently out on the landscape in Utah. Additionally, all of those fish are available as fish health certified from existing sources. In addition to those species, we would also like to include other non-controlled for possession and importation species that are listed under R657-3. So we created that list. The aquaponics industry took a look at it, and they proposed adding three species, jade perch, sleepy cod, and tiger shrimp, to this no COR species list. We conferred internally between sport fish, native fish, fish health professionals, as well as invasive species professionals in the division, and we decided to not add those species to the list for the following reasons. One, there's no escaped wild populations of any of these species that occur currently in the United States. Secondly, where they have escaped in other countries, they are considered to be invasive, and they can carry diseases that threaten cultured or wild fish. It does not preclude the use of these fish in aquaponics industries or culture operations. It just means that if you want to pursue these species, you have to go and get a COR application, put it in, and get it approved. Additionally, CORs will still be available and may be granted in instances where the inverse of what we termed earlier is in play. So the aquaponics facility is not a hobby operation. And in that case, a COR would be attainable from the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. The facility is not closed loop, as I mentioned earlier. Some fish health rules cannot be met. Fish will leave the facility alive, or the species of fish raised is not from the no COR list I presented earlier. Also, some species may require a variance from the Wildlife Board through this process. That's all I have. That is the proposed rule development for aquaponics. I'd like to thank the PAC for their input on the recommended rule and the Utah aquaponics industry for their input on the species list. And at this point in time, I'll take any comments or questions.
Any questions from the public? Any questions from the council? Kevin?
Yeah, I'm just curious. On your list of fish that are allowed, no lake trout, no muskie, no northern, just wondering why.
They're really not something that the aquaponics industry can make use of. Spatially, lake trout, tiger muskie, like you mentioned, you wouldn't be able to get enough fish poop, have enough fish to get enough fish poop for what I would view as a hobby operation, what we termed a hobby operation earlier. These are species that are sought after in this hobby trade.
Any other questions? Comments? Any comments from the public? Any comments from the council? I'll entertain a motion if somebody's got one.
Yeah, I'd make a motion that we accept the recommendation from the presentation as presented.
I'll second that.
I'll read the motion back. So we have a motion on the floor to accept the plan as presented by Kevin and seconded by Aaron. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous.
Thank you very much.
All right, next on the agenda is the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plans. Jace Taylor, Bighorn Sheep Mountain and Mountain Goat Biologist.
Okay. My name is Jace Taylor. I am the Bighorn Sheep and Mountain Goat Biologist for the Division of Wildlife. And today what I'll be presenting are the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plans. A little bit of background here as to how we get to this point in presenting these. Last year, in November of 2018, the Wildlife Board approved the statewide Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. You remember we came around to the RACs and presented those. They were approved at all the RACs and then approved at the board meeting. So once that statewide plan was approved, there were changes in it from the previous version that we needed to incorporate into our unit management plans, our Bighorn Sheep unit management plans. So we've made those changes, and now we're bringing those all to you guys to present them, to get feedback, and then hopefully, if you choose to approve them. In the past, it's worth noting that these unit-specific management plans, which incorporate a lot of the same things as the statewide plan, but get more into the specifics of, you know, area concerns or hurdles, you know, different needs in the specific herds. They have always in the past been internal documents that weren't available to the public. We used them in the DWR to kind of guide our management decisions, habitat treatments or transplants, hunting, anything like that. But we weren't ever required to make them public. We feel that it's important that we, you know, be as transparent as possible. And we thought this would be a good opportunity to bring these out and make them public, get input from people, and that's an important thing. We're excited to do that as we make that effort here. And so once these are approved, the unit management plans will not be presented to the RACs or the Wildlife Board unless there's a significant change, a change to a boundary, a change to a population objective, or if it's a new unit that has never been presented to you before. All the other changes will be approved by the DWR director. Today we're going to go over 18 unit management plans that were in your RAC packet. There's a total of 19 units in the state of Utah. The one that we're not going over today is the Mineral Mountains. That one was presented and approved, remember, May of 2018. And when it was approved at that time, there was nothing in that plan that conflicts the statewide plan, and so we left it as it is, and we're presenting the other 18 here. These 18, for the northern region, we have three of them. The Antelope Island, Newfoundland Mountains, and Pilot Mountains are in your region. 11 of these are Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep units, and 7 of these are Desert Bighorn Sheep units. As I mentioned earlier, the unit plans go into the specifics of the area and the herd, but they do reflect the statewide plan on a few things that I think are important and I wanted to highlight here. They all follow the overarching objective to expand bighorn sheep populations where feasible and to maintain bighorn sheep on a sustainable statewide basis. We feel that's important. Another thing that we feel is very important in these plans is that the DWR will not manage bighorn sheep to the involuntary exclusion of domestic sheep. We've made a lot of strides that way, and I think that that language is reflected in these plans, and we want to make sure that's important, that's clear. And then overall, the DWR's goal is to manage for healthy populations of bighorn sheep that provide quality opportunities for hunting and for viewing. Getting into some of the specific things that are found in each of the plans, we find they're listed a population goal and objective. This is the number of animals that we are striving to have in each of these herds. We feel that it's a suitable number of animals that best fits the available habitat and the conditions in the area. These populations, these estimates of how large the populations are, the abundance for the populations, is obtained when we do helicopter surveys for most of the units, and then some of the units where helicopter surveys don't work, we use ground surveys. And those surveys are done either every year for the less expensive foot surveys, or for those helicopter surveys, they're done every 2 to 3 years. And it's important to note here that that population objective can change as the conditions inside of the unit change. Some of the changes that might take place, we listed here the human development. fire history or fire presence of fire on the landscape can make a big difference in the amount of habitat that's available to bighorn sheep. Water availability, we're talking about free water, drinking water, so that can change with guzzler projects or natural water improvements. And then also the risk of pathogen transmission, which we'll go a little more in depth here about pathogens and some of the risks that they pose to bighorn sheep. Right now, with the 18 plans plus the Mineral Mountains, the current statewide objective is 9,025, and the current population estimate or current abundance is 4,150. What that looks like graphically is this. That red line just there over 9,000 is the statewide objective, and then that blue line is tracking the using those population estimates I talked about earlier. So you can see that we're well below our overall objective, but I think that's something that's important that you can see in this graph is that since 96, you know, we've been able to double the number of bighorn sheep in the state, which has been taking a lot of effort, and we're really proud of that, and we hope that's something that we continue to improve upon. This here, this slide, these tables show those same population objectives that you'll find in each of the unit management plans laid out. And I'll spend a few minutes here because I think this is an important slide. So for each of the units, the first column shows the objective that we're striving for in that unit. And that second column, that last column, is the abundance or our current estimate of the population size. So a few things that you'll notice going through here. First of all, like the previous slide, most of the units are well below their objective, half or even third or fifth of what we're striving for. And a lot of that has to do with some of the struggles. Most of these herds that are well below their objective struggle with respiratory disease. So another thing that's important here is that you'll see the number 125 for a number of these objectives, like Antelope Island, Mount Nebo, Pilot Mountain. Those are populations that are very small, that we don't think realistically we are going to grow very large. And you can see that a number of them aren't at 125, but 125 is a number that we always strive for as kind of a minimum viable population. We think that it's important that we have at least 125 animals over long term so that we have enough animals to allow for enough genetic interchange so that we don't run into inbreeding problems. So that's what the 125 number represents. And then a number of these are broken out into subunits, and so if there's, for example, four subunits inside of one of these units, then you know we end up with that 125 four different times. And so I think it's important to note here that even though a lot of these numbers are, a lot of the current abundances are well below the objectives, it's not our intent to expand the range of a number of most of these units. We want to have more bighorn sheep in the same places that they're currently at. I just want to make that clear so I could understand how that could cause some concern. As I mentioned a couple times earlier, respiratory disease is the most common limiting factor that prevents these populations from reaching their population objective. So for a little bit of background, bighorn sheep, just the way that they have evolved, they are highly susceptible to respiratory disease. There are certain pathogens that when they are contracted into these bighorn sheep populations that we oftentimes see widespread respiratory disease and oftentimes death, loss, die-offs. And so what we do to try to prevent these respiratory disease events is the most important thing is spatial and or temporal separation. And that separation from other animals that we believe carry these pathogens that we're concerned about. The most common carriers for these pathogens are other wild bighorn sheep, which is oftentimes the case how we get pathogens transmitted. And then also domestic sheep and goats are also animals that we try to avoid commingling and have this temporal and or spatial and or temporal separation. Another thing that we try to do is employ emerging technologies to treat herds that have been infected, but also to prevent that commingling that I mentioned earlier. Another thing that we think is important is that we pursue voluntary win-win agreements with individual grazers that, I should say, with individual domestic operators that prevent commingling and allow for more spatial and or temporal separation. And that's another important facet of all these plans is that we're only interested in voluntary situations. Involuntary restrictions or conversions we do not think are appropriate for Utah done in the name of bighorn sheep. Another thing that we engage in is removal of bighorns that stray from places that we believe that they keep them safe from these pathogens, as well as the stray domestic animals that pose threats of transmission. We also think it's important in the state that we manage density, sex ratios, and the age structure of these herds. There's research that's that's underway that will hopefully help us guide, that will hopefully help guide us in the ways that we can best manage these herds to prevent instances of spillover or where commingling happens with other animals. And it's also important to note that with all of our herds, we rotate on a rotational basis. We go through and regularly test the animals in the herds so that we have a better understanding of the current status, the current pathogens that are in those herds. Another common theme throughout all of these plans is the habitat objective, which is overall to maintain or improve bighorn sheep habitat to enhance individual herd success. This habitat's highly important for bighorn, especially when we're talking about managing densities, we're talking about managing distribution. Having habitat that is suitable for them is important for them and for their health. Some of the specifics that the plans go into are drainages or guzzlers or sites where water can be improved, fire management that would help improve bighorn sheep habitat, and then as we mentioned earlier, spatial and or temporal separation. Another one of the common threads throughout all the plans are the recreation objectives. It's important that we try as best we can to meet the needs of Utah's public. It's a difficult thing with bighorn. There's a lot of demand for bighorn sheep, but it's important that we manage them in the proper balance with the other needs of Utah's economic and demands. And so what we try to do is we try to increase public awareness and education while working to expand opportunities to view bighorn sheep. And then we also think that it's important to increase hunting opportunities that populations allow while maintaining quality hunting experiences. With the statewide plan, all of an update that was made to it, all of the unit management plans offer ram permits on 12 to 25 of the counted rams during those surveys I talked earlier, or 30 to 60% of those counted rams, the rams that are counted that are 6 years or older. It's also important that in the units, we, in the unit management plans, we talk about exploring hunts with variable season length, dates, and weapon types, as well as exploring female-only hunts when needed to address density or population concerns. These are our herds that are coming up against their meat, reaching their objectives, and where we need to reduce the number of animals in those herds. And that's everything that I have. Thanks for your time. Appreciate and look forward to any input.
Thanks, Chase. Any questions from the public?
I feel like we talk about this every single time. I'm so freaking short, and I don't think
it's
on.
It's on.
Can you hear me better now? I'll just eat it. Oh, there we go. I got it. Hey, Chase, go back to your population slide. I'm a little bit confused, and I want you to clarify something for me.
Table
on
here.
There, you said your objectives were the minimum objective. So you're telling me the minimum on 9 miles, 1,000 sheep?
If I said minimum, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say minimum.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
When I saw the 125s, I was like, yeah, that's a good... And then I looked down at 1,000 and I went, that's the minimum?
Yeah, okay, I see.
How far are we going?
Yeah, I see. So most of these, no. The objective is what we are striving to have in the unit.
Yeah.
And then when you see 125, the reason why it's not any lower is because we use that as like a baseline minimum.
Right, that's your baseline minimum. That's just what I need to clarify. I mean, I realize that's your objective, and if we can get it up higher and where we're going, that's where you're headed for.
Sure.
And if you get above those unit objectives, then you'll look at more population control.
Yeah, yeah. So a number of the units we have, and the plans go into more of the specifics, where if we reached that number, then we would have aggressive efforts to remove animals either through hunting or through transplants.
Excellent. And then as we're increasing population, obviously there becomes a interest in the ram strain. Yes?
I'm sorry, say it again?
As you increase population, then those rams tend to roam a little bit more.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, yeah, it's something that we're looking more into. We believe that as we get higher ram densities within the units, a higher ram to ewe ratio, there is more incentive for them to wander from the unit. The idea being that the more rams there are per ewe, the fewer opportunities there are for breeding, right? So
yep.
Younger rams become less likely to win breeding opportunities, and then they have more incentive to wander.
Yep.
Yes, that's a good question, yeah.
Thanks much. Oh, sorry, I'm Sierra Nelson. I'm with the Utah Wool Growers. Poor Jace is stuck with me a lot.
Thanks, Sierra.
Any more questions from the public? Questions from the council? Kevin?
Were you able to determine the source of Antelope Island's problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have a district biologist here, so I think we'll ask Eric to come up and talk through a little bit of what we've been able to work out on Antelope Island. If there's other Antelope Island questions while Eric's up here, go ahead and ask him now. I know it's a hot topic.
Yeah, Eric Anderson, the district biologist. So we have a lot of suspicions. We're not sure on the confirmed spot. We know we had some domestic goats and sheep down by the international airport south of the island. And then there was also some domestic sheep up on Fremont Island that could have been possible strains there.
So. Eric?
That may have wandered in or?
Well, we're not sure if the sheep, the domestic sheep came on the island or if the rams left the island. We kind of lean more towards the rams because we were pretty close to 1-to-1 ratio of rams to ewes on the island.
So. Eric, they left the island and then came back?
We assume so, yes. Yeah, that's how the strain got to.
Yeah, that was just for clarification. Thanks,
yes.
Eric.
Yes.
Back to it again. Clarify for me the distance and the route that they'd have to take to do something like that. It's just a
cross and back. So Jace got an illustration up there. I'm not quite sure on the total distance, but it's not uncommon for these sheep to wander. We have documentation of it. I don't know if we have exact distances, do we, Jace?
Yeah, this map, I was hoping this map was a little more zoomed out. It doesn't do the best job for you, Eric. Sorry about that. But, yeah, so the bighorn sheep on Antelope Island, what you can see here in this orange kind of color is the mottled habitat that's suitable for bighorn sheep. And they do use most all of that, especially the stuff that goes to the south end. From the south end of Antelope Island, for a bighorn to be able to leave Antelope Island, he'd have to cover, I think it's 2 or 3 miles of salt flats, or mud flats, right? And then he'd start getting into some of the marsh stuff with the duck clubs and some of that area. And you know, to get that way, it would take him, he could be onto private properties that have the potential to have domestic animals that have the potential to carry the pathogens within 5 miles, something like that. And I think it's important to note here that these are private properties, and everybody in those areas is well within their rights to have any kind of animal that they wish to have there. And they've been very good to work with us since this event, and so I think that it's important that, you know, that we point that out. To go the other way, off the north end of the island, the bighorns do not use very much of the north 3 to 5 miles, so there'd be 3 to 5 miles of habitat that's currently not occupied, and then the causeway is about 7 miles, and if they were to go to Fremont Island, as Eric, you know, mentioned, there's another, I think it's another 4 mile sandbar from the causeway there, or whatever the case may be. None of it impossible for a bighorn sheep, and also, you know, important that everyone in these areas well within their rights to have these animals. So,
correct me if I'm wrong too, Jace, but Antelope Island itself is about 16 miles.
Yeah, I think.
Just for reference.
Yeah, I think roughly 13 to 16 miles.
I have a question. Do they have to come in contact with the sheep, or could it be like a horse trailer? You know, I don't know, was used for goats and then it went out to the island to recreate on a horseback ride or something. Could it be passed that way? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. So generally speaking, the transmission of the pathogens that we're most concerned about, and I think it's probably good to clarify here, there's a number of pathogens that we talk about that are involved in this respiratory disease, right? And there are pathogens that in the past Antelope Island has carried that are part of this complex, respiratory disease complex. What has changed in the last year is that prior to the disease event, there was one specific pathogen that we did not pick up that we did find in the population after the disease event. Okay, so this one specific pathogen we're talking about is just part of the equation. But for this one specific pathogen, that's a most common transmitted by physical contact with another animal that carries the pathogen. It can also be transmitted short distances, aerosol, you know, like coughing on another animal like that. Outside of a host, the pathogen that we're talking about, the specific one, is pretty fragile. It does not do well outside of a host. Only lasts a matter of hours or days, you know, on straw or whatever it might be. So while it is possible, it's pretty unlikely. But good question.
Are there, besides a bullet, is there any other way to solve this? Like,
yeah,
are there,
sure,
like, you know, like we have vaccines for dogs and cattle and all that type of stuff. Is there anything that is being worked on or other treatment for infected animals?
Yeah, currently there is no treatment that we could use in a wild setting that would work well. There's some evidence that some treatments might work, but they're very labor intensive. I mean, multiple nasal washes in a day, and not something we could do with a population of wild bighorns. But there is work being done to hopefully come find a vaccine.
So you've ruled out any chance that it came from any other animal on the island?
No, that's a good question.
I know Antelope Island really well. I've spent a lot of time out there, and I can see the possibility of the south end, but Fremont Island, I don't see an animal being able to get to Fremont Island.
Sure. No, so the question, but the general, it's a good comment, and then also general question of, have we ruled out any other possibility of a different animal? It's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. And the answer is no. There is some newer research that does suggest that there is potential for other ungulates, other animals to be carriers of the disease. That's new research. We are, as I mentioned in the presentation, we are mostly basing our decisions off of the established literature and the bulk of the science that's been presented, but that doesn't mean that we're not open to other things, other new research, and so we are going to sample other ungulates on the island before we reintroduce bighorn sheep. It's a good question.
Two quick questions for you. What are the current plans for antelope to recover it?
Okay, I could do a good job of that.
So this has been quite a process. My first documentation of the contracted disease on the island was this last November. So we've been pretty active on trying to work towards getting wild sheep back on the island. And things are going in the direction we want it, and we plan to release Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep on the island in January.
Would it be from a transfer from within the state, capture and release from inside the state, or are you bringing him in from somewhere else?
Right now, it's currently scheduled to bring him in from Montana and New Mexico.
And how are you going to prevent this from happening again?
So we're working with Antelope Island State Park, and they are currently getting bids on putting a fence around the south end of the island.
And who's going to maintain it?
That's a good question. That's where some of the conservation funds, I hope, will help maintain that, and it'll be the responsibility, I believe, of Antelope Island State Park, but we'll help out as needed and can.
How would the fence work? You can't extend it forever. Excuse me, you can't extend it forever. So what's the concept behind that?
Correct. So we're working with Steve Bates, who's the wildlife biologist for Antelope Island State Park, and he has issues with his bison also. So it's going to be basically a U-shaped just around the south end of the island. And yeah, it's, I don't know how many years it's been dry through there, but you know, there's always a chance of more water coming in and this and that. But that's the plan now, to put that in. I believe it's almost about 5 miles up on the east side.
So. Okay. Then, Jace, the second question was for you. In your presentation, you're talking about working out win-win solutions
with
grazers.
Sure.
What are you defining as a win-win? Getting different allotments someplace further away? Or
something like that. Yeah, we've had folks, you know, that are willing to take a different wintering allotment, for example, so that it makes more separation from where we have bighorn sheep. Some folks are interested in getting out of the business altogether at times. And so, you know, those are kind of some of the win-win situations that have happened in the past. It's important to us that they are win-win, you know, voluntary. And that's an important thing for us. So,
James?
Yeah.
The Newfoundland Mountain Range is, when the bighorns was placed on there, was the domestic sheep grazing allotments surrendered, or are they still in place?
No, they were surrendered beforehand. Surrendered before the bighorn sheep were reintroduced to that area. I should probably have Jim come up. Jim knows a little better the history there. Thanks, Jim.
Jim Christensen, Assistant Wildlife Manager. So they were actually converted to cattle. So those is what happened to those.
How far would it be for one of your rams to travel off the Newfoundlands onto the Hoggos?
Oh, it's...
Throw a rock and hit it.
It's probably four,
they trail sheep back and forth across there for hundreds of years.
Right.
And now you don't think your rams are going to travel?
They very well could. We do have GPS collars on some of our rams and ewes out on the Newfoundlands, and they have not gone off. I do know when we first, well, with some of the first introductions out there, they did release some very old mature rams, and they did leave, and they went to the east over on the grassies, or over by the bombing range anyway, mm-hmm. and those two males hung out right there. They had pictures of them over on the military range for years and years, and they were both those rams were together. One of them ended up dying or whatever happened. The other one did get off on the BLM ground. We had an alternate hunter from our alternate list go out and harvest that ram. And then since that time, there's been no known sheep off the Newfoundland
herd. Thank you.
Any other comments from the council? I'm sorry, questions from the council. Comments from the public. I've got some cards. If you haven't filled out your card yet, get that turned in. I'll read them. Spencer Gibbons. Are you here, Spencer? I think I was just supposed to read this one. He represents Utah Farm Bureau, and they support the plan. We feel all the tools to manage bighorn sheep and minimize livestock conflict are in the plan. We appreciate the cooperation and efforts of the DWR have made to work on in concert with the agriculture community. Thank you. And that's Spencer Gibbons. Next on the comment from the public, Sierra Nelson, representing Utah Wool Growers Association.
Thanks for your time tonight. I really appreciate you guys. The Utah Wool Growers Association would like to support the plan and the plans as they're written, as long as they stick to it close, where we have this close relationship where we're working together to minimize the impact on domestic livestock in the state. And as we continue to work together, I think we can flourish both. You know, we can have the bighorns, we can still have a good, hearty domestic industry as long as we continue to work together. So we appreciate DWR, we really appreciate the SFW working with us and the things that we've accomplished together. So thank you for your time.
Next is Brad Buchanan. He's representing SFW in Utah. Wild Sheep Foundation. Sorry, Brad.
Brad Buchanan, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife and Utah Wild Sheep Foundation. We support the division's plan as been presented. And with that, as far as Antelope Island is concerned, we are asking, because that is a nursery herd, it's been demonstrated you can get ram heavy there. We do ask that as it proceeds and gets to that point, we do have discussions with the state parks and begin to pursue an increase in the public permits for Antelope Island, offer some more opportunity there to harvest some sheep, as well as help to lower and mitigate the risk of some wandering rams. So, thank you.
Thanks, Brad. Comments from the council? Aaron?
I think it's a good plan. I'll never in my life be able to harvest one just based on the odds. And so I just hope that they do watch it closely and it doesn't affect the agriculture people. I'm not going to go out and look at one per se. And so I just hope that it works out for the best of both of them.
Thanks, Aaron. Any other comments from the council? Any motion? Kevin?
Yeah, I'll make a motion that that the plan be accepted with the input that we've gotten from the other groups in the audience, and accept that the program as presented.
I'll second it.
Be specific. Justin brings up a good point. Can you be a little more specific on the increase in tags on the comments? Was that what you were talking about, was the increase in tags?
Who are you talking to?
Randy. Wasn't it Randy that made the comment?
All I said is I second it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Randy. I had my head down. I was writing down. He gave me the motion. Was it Aaron? Kevin. Be more specific on the comments. You said something about the comments.
Well, the input from the audience, I believe, supported the plan.
Okay.
There was a comment about from SFW and that they look at increasing permits on Antelope Island in the future. They're not even a herd on Antelope Island right now. I think we could address that sooner. But so I think that from what I heard from the public, is that they're supportive, and I would recommend or make the motion that we accept it as presented.
Thank you, Kevin. And we got the second from Randy. The motion is to accept the presentation as presented. All in favor, raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous. It passes. If there's no further business and there are no objection, the meeting will be adjourned. No objection. There being no objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.